Hello, Jepper dudes and Jepper dorks. Welcome to What Is a Jeopardy podcast, where we make fun of the smartest show on television, even though I have rear-ended someone three times.
The same person?
Nope.
Okay.
Three different rear-end car accidents, which, if you know anything about car accidents, always deemed your fault.
Yeah.
So I think that makes me stupid. I would say two of the three, not my fault, ultimately. But I've been in three, so I guess
it was your fault.
Yeah, what can I say? In the eyes of the law, I am a serial rear-ender.
And that's the poll quote, people.
And that's the bottom line, because Stone Cold said so. That is, I guess, the title of the episode. John has rear-ended three people, and I mean with my car.
Okay. I live in LA, so that just doesn't seem like a really high number of car accidents to have been in.
Well, I've been in more car accidents than that. I guess it's just more like it feels like you feel dumb when you rear-end someone, I think.
Yeah.
Even if it wasn't your fault. Like, the one time was genuinely, I was on the highway and there was a cop had pulled someone over on the other side of the highway.
Oh,
and this
God.
Is a Canadian highway where there is a ditch in the middle of the two. So it's like, it's not even close to us. And the person just saw the flashing police lights and just jammed on their brakes in front of me. Like,
oh,
to
my
a
God.
Full stop. And so I just rear-ended them. And I was like, what the hell? But that's apparently my fault. So.
That one doesn't sound like your fault, but it is your fault.
Exactly. That's what I'm saying. Anyway,
this you're following week, too close.
It is. I know. It is my fault. It's all my fault.
I did have a friend one time tell me about a car accident and be like, and it was so not my fault. And then she sent me security footage of the accident. And I was like, that was your fault.
And did they had seen the footage and they still didn't think.
Yeah.
Wow. Okay. Because I feel like I could be pretty objective after I saw footage of an accident.
Oh, God. I should send it to you.
I would love to see it. Don't tell me which car is theirs. And then I'll just be like, that's the car whose fault it was. And then
it'll be obvious.
Okay. Awesome.
All right.
This week, it is our first full week of regular gameplay for season 40. And we've already got our first TOC qualifier of the season. Plus, a clue about Harley Quinn leaves Jeopardy fans Joker-fied, and Churchill coins a new word. I hope it's something dirty.
Let's get into the game recap. Monday, April 15th, our contestants are Adam Seif, an attorney from Los Angeles, California, Joshua Beckett, an ethicist originally from Knoxville, Tennessee, and Allison Betts, a writer and creative executive originally from San Jose, California, whose two-day cash winnings total $61,700. It's a close game between Allison and Joshua in the Jeopardy round, with Allison finding the Daily Double halfway through and adding $3,000, which ends up being just about her lead at the end of the round. Meanwhile, it's not until the Double Jeopardy round that Adam gets in on the buzzer, but he doesn't get to celebrate for long because soon Allison has found both Daily Doubles. By the 22nd clue, she's got a runaway game. Final Jeopardy category is Great Brits. The clue, from 1689 to 1690 and 1701 to 1702, he served as a member of parliament representing the constituency of Cambridge University. Adam guesses lock while Allison and Joshua both come up with the correct response of Sir Isaac Newton. And just like the Cool and the Gang song referenced in a $400 clue, it's time to celebrate good times. Come on, because Allison has won her third game.
Celebrate good times. Come on.
Okay, we can't afford to sing the song. The rights, we just don't have.
Isn't singing fair use? Isn't
I think you have to change the lyrics. You have to weird out it a little bit.
to not get dinged?
No, I think it's fine. I think it's fine. Also, no one listens to this podcast. So
celebrate
that's good.
Good times. You're on. There we go. Is that Dan? Swap that in.
It sucks.
So we don't get sued.
John, what did you think of this game?
It was good. It was nice. Cool. It was cool.
Cool. Good job.
It was cool to see this game.
Here's something I noticed in this game.
I love seeing stuff. Do you like seeing stuff?
God. Okay. In the Double Jeopardy round, after both daily doubles had been found, Allison was still by rote jumping to the $2,000 clues.
Yes.
In new categories, even when she said, "I'm bad at this category."
Yeah, we may hear that response later on. Yes. In the responses of the week, because I am sort of the mind, you know, the Jeopardy categories are less so, I would say less so now because of the way most people play the game, hunting for daily doubles. But it used to be that the $200 or $400 clues served as instruction for the category. Like, obviously, if the category is world history, you know what the clues are going to be about. But like in a category where maybe the title is a little more obscure, or it's you're not exactly sure what the answer, you know, or what the theme might be of the category, you start at the top with an easy question so you can figure out, oh, that is how the category goes. So yes, when both of the daily doubles are off the board, it actually does behoove you to play top down instead of still going down up.
Yeah. It really was a move that made no sense. But other than that, great game. I love to see a runaway.
Yeah, you love runaways.
I do. I love runaways where they get Final Jeopardy correct.
Yeah.
Because then you feel like they deserve it.
Yeah.
Allison did great.
It was good. Allison had a very good first two games, but it was nice to see this like dominant third game. I thought this was her best game. I mean, I know she had good money totals the other two games, but this one just felt, and Joshua, don't get me wrong, had a good Jeopardy round actually. And he, you know, him and Allison were kind of going back and forth, and I was like, okay, this could be interesting, you know? And then Allison really put her stamp on it in Double Jeopardy, and it was it was fun to watch. And the type of game where, you know, you could kind of tell that Allison was maybe heading towards a TOC berth, even with such a strong 3-day total.
Is that what it's called? A berth?
A berth in the Tournament of Champions? Yes. Not like she is birthed into the Tournament of Champions. It's like a sports thing. It's like a playoff berth. Like you clinched a playoff berth, but it's like B-E-R-T-H. Like
I knew which spelling you were talking about. I just had never heard it before. My only like tournament
the
frame
TOC
of reference
is pregnant and Allison is in its tummy.
My only like tournament jargon reference is high school debate. And so.
What do those tournaments look like?
Well, okay, so we had
probably
TOC.
A ton of sex, I guess, going on there. Just
honestly,
a lot of,
there was a lot of sex happening. None of it by me, but way more than you'd expect, considering most of the people doing it looked like.
I was actually being serious because it's like all the nerds could get with the other nerds from the other schools. It's
like. Yeah. And if you were like a good debater, it has like the same effect as like being a famous person, where it's like if you're like a famous actor, even if you're like a character actor, like it still kind of works. Yeah. I don't know why that was the case for high school debate, but it absolutely was. And also, you're just like traveling around in hotels and you're in high school and like.
Right.
But the way it worked was like to qualify for the TOC, you had to get a certain number of bids.
Okay, what does that mean?
And like, that meant like
the thing was called the Tournament of Champions also?
Yeah, it was called the TOC.
Okay.
That's why it rolls off my tongue so naturally.
Cuz you were in the TOC so often.
Because I was in the TOC my senior year, bitch. I did not break to the out rounds, but I earned bids
at I don't know what that means.
Finally, I'm using jargon that you don't know. And it makes me sound really cool.
It does. I didn't even get into the out rounds. I'm like, oh, you dumb idiot.
So, okay, here's how the tournaments work. You have like, I think 7 or 8 prelim rounds, which is like everyone competes. And then based on your stats in those rounds, the top competitors will break to the out rounds, which is the bracketed part of the tournament.
I see.
And depending on how prestigious the tournament is, you can earn a bid to the TOC at various stages in the tournament. So like a less well-known tournament, you'll earn a bid in like the finals.
Like, if you make it to
the finals. Yeah.
Okay.
Gotcha. But then like some of the harder ones, it's like you can earn a bid in the octafinals.
The octafinals.
Yeah. So they would break to double octas usually. Okay.
Is octafinals though, is that, do we just normally call those quarterfinals when there's like 8 people left?
No, it's like double octafinals, octafinals, quarterfinals, semifinals, finals.
Oh, I see. So yeah, the sweet 16,
so.
You call the octafinals.
Am I wrong?
Oh, yeah, that could be right. That's 8 games, right? That, yeah. Like 8 matches would be the round of 16.
But this is a good use of the podcast,
no,
right?
You know what? Here's the thing, though. I was thinking, like, yes, we are very sidetracked right now, but also talking about high school debate on a Jeopardy podcast is like,
we haven't alienated anyone.
Yeah, so everyone's turned the radio up, if anything. You're like, she went to the TOC and the California debates. Holy shit. And their headphones are cranked. Who was like the stud like debater in your era? Was there like one person where you were just like, hell yeah, dog. Oh. They're the alpha.
Okay. So there were a few. I remember I wrote my college essay about going up against Oscar Schein at the Alta tournament when I was a junior. Like, he was the hot shit senior when I was like a junior. But and I think he might have won nationals, but I don't think he did as well at the TOC. I'm trying to remember who won the TOC
Oscar
when I was
Schein
a senior.
Sounds like a made up name, by the way. There was a movie about high school. That would be the villain.
But he was actually
Oscar Schein.
He was actually really nice.
Anyway, great job, Allison. Really good work. Congratulations on your win. On Tuesday, April 16th, our contestants are Eric Raymond, a substitute teacher originally from Collegeville, Pennsylvania. Now, only in America would there be a city just called Collegeville. And everyone just has a straight face about that. They're like, yeah, it's where the college is.
It sounds like what we would like make up as the place that a fucking Jeopardy nerd was from.
That is also true too. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. This Oscar Schein from college, from Debate Town, USA. Veronica Tabor, a study abroad advisor from Ann Arbor, Michigan, and Allison Betts, a writer and creative executive originally from San Jose, California, whose 3-day cash winnings total $97,500. Allison ends the Jeopardy round with a big lead thanks to buzzer dominance and a daily double find. But in Double Jeopardy, Eric finds his buzzer timing.
He found his mother.
Eric was so buzzer in Double Jeopardy, finding both daily doubles early on. The first one gets him close enough to be in position to take the lead when he finds the second in Say It in Spanish. Unfortunately, his last minute correct guess of burrito is not phrased in the form of a question, and he drops down to $2,000 with plenty of game left. Miraculously, Eric builds back from there with one clue to go. Allison and Eric are tied, meaning the lead going into final comes down to who can buzz in first and name Mary Kate and Ashley Olsen. And to Eric, I say, you got it, dude. Veronica, unfortunately, cannot compete in Final Jeopardy, so it's just Allison and Eric contending with the category words and their meanings. The clue, Churchill gave a word a new meaning when he called for a talk with Soviet Russia upon the highest level, a parley at this. Neither of them come up with the correct response of summit, so thanks to a conservative wager from Allison, she is now a 4-day champion. Emily, what did you think about Tuesday?
Oh, I mean, my favorite part of this game was when Ken was visibly upset that no one guessed Beetlejuice, which was a really easy question. You have to agree. And yes. I mean, very tough break for Eric on that daily double. I mean, he didn't know it, so I don't feel that bad that he was ruled incorrect on the phrasing, because it was a real shrug and really
random,
like,
guess. Yeah.
Random guess after the time had run out. I feel like this was a performance that is deserving of the second chance tournament. What did you think?
Yeah, I think it's definitely possible we could see Eric in there with Burrito, and the fact that nobody got final right. I think both of those things are big factors. Yeah, it seemed like they definitely looked for second chancers who were in similar situations. Like, I know with Long Nguyen, like, he finished, I think, with like $800, but it was because he bet big on a daily double late in Double Jeopardy and didn't get it right. But they were like, oh, that's a really good player, you know. And I think Eric showed that as well. Like you said, I think it was just about buzzer timing in the Jeopardy round. But then once he figured it, because Allison, it was just coming off that runaway 3-day champ with a very impressive average game total. After Jeopardy, I was like, well, this is over. I mean, Eric and Veronica are toast. They're screwed. But Eric really picked it up. And I will say, not to be that guy, but I was shocked that none of them got Final Jeopardy, because I thought it was fairly easy. That was a pretty much an instant get for me.
Okay. Well, good for you.
Thank you.
This was one where I'm like, I probably would have gotten it, but Peter got it before I did, and so then I didn't have to think about it anymore. So no one will ever know if I would have gotten this correct.
It just was like, there were just enough clues in there where it was like, okay, the talking at the top of the, you know, the way the clue was phrased kind of insinuated that it was like the highest level. So, you know, you start thinking, what is the highest level? And then I think you get pretty close to summit when you think like, oh, meetings are called summits. That's weird. They're called summits. Etc.
Right. It's funny though that you're like, even in that clue, you're like, the word that I get stuck on is parlay, which is like pirate code or something. Yes. And it's
it's just like an English guy saying parlay, but saying it parley, which is really je ne pas parley Francis.
All right. Well, that was Tuesday. It's time to get to know our hosts. So, John, it says here you might have to get braces.
Emily, I am not in a good place right now.
Oh, because no.
I am a 38-year-old man facing down the potential of braces. I never had braces growing up. I always had perfect teeth. And then,
my sympathy for you is dwindling rapidly.
Okay. Would you not rather have braces when you're 15 than when you're fucking 38? Because
I don't know. I'm a lot more secure in myself now. I honestly feel like I could pull them off better than when I was 13. But
okay, fair enough. Fair enough. And I can understand that. But I never had braces. Then a couple things happened. I got two of my front teeth knocked out playing hockey. Very Canadian of me. So I have two. My front two teeth are half fake. They're both, well, one is totally fake. The other one is half. They were like chipped. One was chipped in half and the other one was chipped like 75%. And then I got two of my wisdom teeth taken out, but not the other two, because these ones were growing in sideways and these ones are fine. And at the time I had no dental coverage. So the dentist was like, well, we can take all four of them out, but these two are totally fine. So we don't have to if you don't want to. And I was like, well, I can't afford it. So sure, just take out these two. So these wisdom teeth are still growing in and these ones are out. So basically it's poked out. You can't really see, but it's poked out my bottom tooth and I've just waited too long. And now it's almost like fully in front of my other bottom teeth. And I'm hoping I can get Invisalign, but I might have to get braces, which would suck really bad. But I'm seeing your orthodontist in May. So. Yeah.
Wait, you guys had socialized medicine over there. You didn't have dental coverage?
Dental's not covered.
Dental's not included. Too much hockey. They're like, we can't afford this.
Genuinely, that's probably part of it, honestly. Yeah. It's like, it's dental and eye stuff is also not covered.
Yeah.
Like optometry. Yeah. So you usually get it through work, but I was, at the time substitute teaching, and I would have had to pay for my dental benefits out of pocket. And they were very expensive relative to like just getting a couple cleanings a year. Like I would have been overpaying. It would almost have been like insurance in case my teeth got knocked out or I needed my wisdom teeth out, but I didn't know that either of those things would happen. So anyway,
well, I hope braces. You...
That's really the important thing here is I might be a loser for a couple. They're saying yeah. like 18 what? Imagine, months.
Imagine your life, but people are bullying you all of a sudden for the first time.
Oh no, I was in the gifted program. I was getting bullied.
I'm just kidding. I bully you on this podcast. Like you are already currently bullied.
Damn it. I get bullied on all my podcasts, actually. So that's yeah. that is true. Emily, now this sounds like sort of the opposite story for you. I'm like, I might have to get braces. I'm a fucking yeah. loser. No. But it says here you were mentioned on a pretty high profile podcast this week. Tell me more.
That's right, John. Okay, so they're doing a new podcast about the history of the Lonely Island.
Oh yes,
with
yes.
Seth Meyers. And
I've been meaning to listen.
I started listening. It's actually pretty interesting, even though I like already felt like I was like, oh, what more can I learn?
But, yeah, you like know them.
Yorma is my brother-in-law.
Yeah, you're like you're listening to the pod. Like, oh yeah, he told me this story when we were camping.
There's a lot of like behind the scenes stuff that no right. one knows.
Sure.
And they did an episode about Lazy Sunday, which I am in.
Yes.
I play the cashier in that viral video. And I am briefly mentioned in the podcast.
And did they plug this podcast or
no?
Well, what the hell then? Why even bother getting mentioned?
Because it felt like a Jeopardy anecdote.
No, it is a Jeopardy anecdote, no question. But I'm just saying, like, come on, Yorma, like, throw us a fucking bone here, dude.
It was funny too because they were like, they were mentioned it, and they were like, oh yeah, and she's a comedian now, and like. And Andy was like, oh, yeah. And she, I don't think she had started doing stand up yet when we were doing this. And Yorma was like, oh, no, she had, which I had not. I was like, why does Andy know this and you don't?
Yeah, well, I listened to you on another podcast where you were talking about that. And yeah. You had kind of said that it did make you quasi famous because yes. you were in college at the time.
I was in college. I was just visiting my sister in New York when they filmed that, and they truly were making these shorts with no resources from the show whatsoever, completely on their own. And they were like, and Yorma was just like, "Do you want to be in a video today?" And I was like, "Sure." We didn't know if it was going to be on TV or not, and then it was like the biggest thing ever.
Yeah.
And especially on a college campus, like UC Santa Cruz, where everyone is smoking a shitload of weed. And it started getting around that like the girl from that video goes here, and people Whoa. Would come up to me at parties and be like, "You look like that girl." And I was like,
"You're like, yo,
it was me.
Let me show you something." Did you? Well, here's the real question: did you get laid off the Lazy Sunday video?
I'll never know. Probably.
Hell yeah, that's sick. I guess it would be tough to know exactly, but
yeah, I mean, there have been times when I'm like, I know why this is happening. But most of the time I didn't.
Most of the time you just had to settle for the old like, I guess they think I'm hot, instead of the they know me from stand-up / this famous viral video.
Yeah.
Yeah, shout out. That's cool. Okay, Wednesday. That's you, not me. I was like, we got to get out of here. I got to stop talking about this. What happened on Wednesday?
Oh, wait, it's my turn. Wednesday, April 17th.
That's why I stopped saying that.
Okay, yeah. I forgot it was my turn. Wednesday, April 17th, our contestants are Jeff Plate. Sorry. That is a fucking Toast of London ass name. Do you watch Toast of London?
No.
Okay.
And I do love the name Jeff.
Okay. So Toast of London was Matt Berry's show in the UK, where all of the characters' names were, like, their last names were all very stupid.
This guy's like gonna listen to the show and be like, what the fuck? I mean, I guess if your last name is Plate, you got to know the deal.
Yeah, you got to know. But like a lot of their last names were like food items. I mean, the main guy's name was Toast.
Right.
It's been a while since I've watched it, but there was someone. I just found a list of all of the Toast of London character names. Some of them include Dwight Difference.
Great, yeah.
Norris Flipjack. Clem Fandango is one of the more famous characters because he's in every episode.
I've heard that, yeah.
Yeah. You know, you get the gist, but every so
is
often
I... Is there a better first name for that, though? Jeff Plate? Like, that's the perfect... No,
it's Jeff the perfect, Plate. Yeah. And Ray Purchase was, like, also... But it's just very... Someone named Strawberry Rathbone. Hercule Razzmatazz. Anyway, every so often I see a name and I'm like, that's a Toast of London name. Like, I saw a name on a plaque somewhere that said Josh Beveridge. I was like, come on. Okay, sorry. Jeff Plate, an attorney from Asbury Park, New Jersey. Vidya Ravella, a business development executive originally from Skokie, Illinois. And Allison Betts, a writer and creative executive originally from San Jose, California, whose four-day cash winnings total $107,700. Vidya and Jeff both spend the first part of the Jeopardy round in the red, but it's a tough round for everyone. Even Allison, who gets in first on the buzzer for 15 clues, but misses a third of them, keeping her score low. Allison has $3,600 going into Double Jeopardy, while Vidya and Jeff are tied at $2,200. Vidya takes the lead by picking up the first two clues, but Allison finds the first Daily Double and wisely bets everything, jumping into the lead. Two clues later, Vidya finds the second Daily Double and loses everything but $600. She spends the rest of the round attempting to come back, but going into final, her score is as red as a jester's coxcomb cap, as referenced in the Ends With B category. It's moot because Allison has secured another runaway game with $12,800 to Jeff's $5,400. Final Jeopardy category is organizations. The clue: the press called the donations received after this org's 1938 founding a silver tide, which actually swamped the White House. Allison is the only player to correctly write down the March of Dimes, and with that, she is the first competitor this season to punch her ticket to the Tournament of Champions. John, what did you think of this game?
I was very surprised the guy named Jeff Plate didn't know the clue about collecting money. Anyway.
He's like, please, Plate is my father's name.
Just call me Jeff.
Jeff Saucer.
Oh boy. We're having some fun over here. I thought Vidya quite a good player. It was really unfortunate that she got tripped up on that Daily Double. Love the aggressive bid. You know, I think in the in the spot she was in, especially against a four-day champion, I thought it was the right move to bid it all there. Almost all of it. And then she just did the thing where she just tried to claw her way back into the game. And, you know, sometimes you get a little bit desperate. You're ringing on stuff that you're maybe not 100% sure about when that happens. And, you know, I would say one of the better players that I can remember of recent note to end up in the red. You know, usually when people end up in the red, you're like, yeah, they just, you know, they kind of never put it together. They're not good all game. And they end up in the red. But that was genuinely, like, I felt bad for her because I think she was a good player that just got a little bit unlucky there.
I mean, Allison got more questions wrong than Vidya did this game.
Yeah.
And I feel like that is worth mentioning. Vidya got 14 right, 5 wrong. Allison got 19 right, 8 wrong. Like,
yeah,
that's not a huge difference in, you know.
Honestly, like, if you're getting 8 wrong, you're probably not winning most of the time. Like, the, you know, usually when you see someone win, it's not so much about how many they get right. Obviously, that's a factor, but it's more about how many they get wrong. You know, usually a champion is 5 or less incorrect answers in a game. So, so that was, tough for Vidya. I thought it was, another decently solid game from Allison. I did think it was maybe her weakest game overall, but solid though still. Got final right. So even if it was, even if Jeff was closer or Vidya was involved, that could have still been a winning game for her. I had no idea of that final, if that helps me balance out my summit ego talk.
I know this one.
March of
this
Dimes.
Was another one that Peter got, and I didn't have to think about.
They seem like a forgotten charity to me. I've moved on.
March of Dimes. They're like, still around.
Yeah, do they even make dimes anymore? You know, I'm over it.
Thought it was unfortunate timing that Jeopardy could not have known about, that they had a clue about all that shortly after a very popular documentary about the abusive behind the scenes. I was just like, oh god, they did not know they were tough. About to evoke something horrible.
That was like,
why am I evoking it now? I didn't need to do that.
Well, it reminded me of, there was a clue last season about Oppenheimer, like the answer was Oppenheimer, like the guy, and it was right in the middle of all the Barbenheimer hype, and the Oppenheimer clue, it was in like either the $1,000 or the $2,000 spot, but it was just like so obvious because all anybody had been talking about for last month was Barbenheimer. And you could almost see Ken even being like, that movie's out, it's coming out or whatever, you know. Yeah. That was,
no one thought that movie was going to like capture the public imagination the way it did.
Of course not. Of course not. So, tough. I did watch that documentary. It was rough. Tough watch. Not a good time.
Not a fun time. Anyway, let's move on to Thursday.
Thursday, April 18th, our contestants are Marco Saric, a math professor from Chapel Hill, North Carolina, Rob Blumenstein, a paralegal originally from Montreal, Quebec, Canada, and Allison Betts, a writer and creative executive originally from San Jose, California, whose 5-day cash winnings total $121,500. Thanks to Allison missing the first daily double, it's a very close game at the end of the Jeopardy round, only $1,400 separating first and third place headed into Double Jeopardy. Rob finds the first daily double, jumping into the lead, but Marco finds the second, pulling ahead. He builds on this momentum a bit before Allison stages a comeback, briefly retaking the lead, but then Marco does, as described in the 9-letter words daily double clue, and fabricates another run of correct responses. It's a tight game going into final, but Marco has the lead. The final Jeopardy category is Alphabetical America, the clue. Until Alabama became the 22nd state, this one was first alphabetically. All three players guess Arkansas when the correct answer is Connecticut, so it all comes down to the wagers, and because Allison bet big enough to cover Rob's impressive third-place score, she pays dearly for getting it wrong, and Marco's final score of $37.99 is enough to make him a Jeopardy champion. What do you have to say about Thursday?
I mean, this was such a close game.
Very close.
All three really good players. I mean, I feel like we're going to do this fucking so often now, but I'm like, oh, you know, Rob, for a second chance, maybe. I don't know. This was a tough game to win against Allison and Marco. Marco did very well. Allison did very well, as is her wont. I mean, I thought this final Jeopardy was very American. How did you do on it?
So I actually think being an ignorant Canadian helped me get it right. Because I got it right immediately. And the only reason I got it right is because I could not think of another A state other than Alabama and Alaska. So I was just like, You know, so obviously the three of them take the obvious neg bait of Arkansas, but, you know, the whole sort of like, you know, I guess hitch in the clue is that Arkansas was admitted to Confederation after. Do they call it Confederation in America? In Canada, that's what we call it. I don't know what it is.
No, we have some negative associations with Confederacy.
Okay, yeah, sorry. In Canada, we call it whatever the fuck you guys call it down there. Arkansas became a state after the Union. Yeah, became a state after Arkansas, or sorry, after Alabama. So anyway, I was just like, okay, I know that there's no states that start with a B. That's like one of those just like kind of things that you know. And then I was like, okay, so it's got it. And I knew Connecticut was one of the original 13 colonies. So I was just like, I think it's got to be Connecticut. And then literally as soon as Rob had written down Arkansas, I was like, ah, shoot, Arkansas. I forgot that there's another A state. And then Ken was like, ooh, that's wrong. And I was like, shit.
Yeah. Here's something that might be useful to people is, I can usually name most of the states in order because of a song that my sister taught me.
Okay.
That's called, I think it's just called the United States. Because the beginning goes, the United States, the United States. I love my country, the United States. There's Alabama, Alaska, Arizona, Arkansas, California, Colorado, Connecticut, Delaware, Florida, Georgia, Hawaii, and Idaho, Illinois, Indiana, Iowa, and Kansas, et cetera, et cetera.
Louisiana. I get you. Las Vegas.
I think I only know it through Kansas and then I forget the tune, but usually that gets me pretty far.
I got there. I got to Connecticut. Did you guess Arkansas then when you were playing along?
I was like, remember? It's Arkansas or Connecticut.
Right.
I think
you just weren't
sure
when Arkansas joined the Union.
Yeah, but I should have been able to get there because it's west of Alabama. So
yeah,
it usually goes in that approximate order. Mm-hmm. But there were people online who thought that it was maybe an unfair or trick question, but it absolutely is not.
Well, I just saw Andy from the Jeopardy fan. I don't want to blow this up here, but I talked about this last week. I think I joined this Jeopardy Discord and I've been playing Jeopardy games online. It's from the Jeopardy Reddit. Basically, a bunch of people in the Jeopardy Reddit created this Discord, and then people play Jeopardy games against each other all the time. And Marco is a very active member of this Discord and is like one of the top players on this Discord. So people heard that Marco was going to be on Jeopardy, they were like, oh, he's going to be a really good player. And Andy, who runs the Jeopardy fan, was saying in the Discord that he felt like this was a clue that was the difficulty was more appropriate for a JIT Masters Tournament of Champions level Final Jeopardy question, because he felt like the neg bait of Arkansas was too tricky, that like they were asking the players to do too much in the question of both knowing all the states in alphabetical order, but then also parsing that Arkansas would have joined the Union after Alabama.
Yeah.
So there was some talk of that in the Discord, I will say.
Yeah. And I mean, that makes a certain amount of sense, but, I was like, you could get there. I was surprised that this was a triple stumper.
I will say as well, I don't think Rob will get in the second chance. And here's why. That is a bad bid in his spot. Very bad bid. Rob should have won that game. Any player in that position, in that third position, with the top two being so close to each other, the only appropriate bid for Rob in that spot is to bid enough to cover Allison in case Allison bids zero. Which it wouldn't make much sense for Allison to bid zero, but in the event that she does, Marco's almost never bidding zero there, especially when the category is alphabetical America. You probably figure you've got a decent chance of getting that right.
That's a good point.
Yeah. So Rob needed to bid zero or like $2,000 to cover Allison. Him betting it all makes no difference, because him betting it all still is relying on Allison and Marco getting it wrong.
In which case,
you don't bet at all, right? You still
at most you bet to cover Marco getting it wrong and betting zero, which he's not going to do. Yeah. That's a fair point. I guess for some reason I was like, oh yeah, why would they factor in what your wages are to, but it's part of the game.
It is part of the game.
Let's move on to Friday, April 19th. Our contestants are Molly Fitzpatrick, a writer from Queens, New York. Scott Nations, another Toast of London-ass name. A financial engineer.
I couldn't stop laughing when I said Scott Nations.
Yeah. Sounds You're all citizens of Scott Nations now. Welcome.
Sounds like it would be like the joke nameplate of like the United Nations ripoff in a cartoon. Hi, I'm the president of the Coalition of Countries. My name is Scott Nations.
I want to say when they said his name, Peter was like, Scott Nations? Oh, you mean like Scotland? okay, Scott Nations, a financial engineer and option trader from Chicago, Illinois, and Marco Sarek, a math professor from Chapel Hill, North Carolina, whose one day cash winnings total $3,799. Marco Sarek, by the way, is a professor at Elon University, which is not Elon Musk's university, I don't think, but it really sounds like it.
Yeah, it really shouldn't be.
Molly starts out strong in the Jeopardy round, despite missing the first daily double, and she's just taken the lead from Marco when we hit the first break, but Marco has taken the lead back going into Double Jeopardy. Marco finds the first daily double in the round and misses, dropping down to $1,900. But unlike renowned freediver Herbert Nitsch, Marco's not making it a habit of dropping further down. He goes on a tear.
Wow. That's some special stuff.
He goes on a tear, not providing a single incorrect response for the rest of the game, heading into Final Jeopardy with a $4,500 lead. Final Jeopardy category is comic book characters. The Clue, featured in a 2020 film, she gets her name from a 16th century Italian stock character who often wore diamond patterned outfits. Scott gets it wrong, guessing Wonder Woman, while Molly and Marco correctly respond Harley Quinn. Marco ends the game with $22,801 and ends the week as a two-day champion. John, what did you think of this game?
Good game from Marco. Had a good game, obviously, in the Thursday game, had to fight back from missing a daily double in that one, but did so. And it was just it was a good performance. Or sorry, that was this game. Sorry, my apologies. This was the game where Marco bets big and has to get his lead all the way back. He gets the daily double wrong and still gets himself into a pretty good lead by the end, which was really impressive. He just seems like a very solid player. I thought that was a very easy Final Jeopardy.
Yeah. Felt it's the rare situation where Scott Nations writing down Wonder Woman kind of makes him less of a loser.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
He's like, I don't know about these fucking comic book characters.
Yeah. I don't know. When these comic books were coming out, I was having sex and drinking and smoking cigarettes. I wasn't paying attention to this bullshit. Totally. Like, it's, I thought it was a good, that was a good game from Marco. Really impressive comeback after missing that daily double. And Allison punched a ticket to the TOC. Marco has a little bit of that that feel of like that level of player. We'll see how he puts it together this week. Obviously, as you're listening to this episode, we'll already have seen at least one of Marco's games, depending on when you listen to it. But I just thought it was a really strong game from him.
Yeah, he's got good buzzer. He was in first 42.11%, which is pretty good.
Yeah.
So 23 correct, 3 incorrect. Pretty good. Molly has more incorrect, but she probably had to buzz in as much as she could considering who she was up against. So I thought that in this game there was pretty clear Ken cutting off an impending bring it.
he does not want people to do it.
He does not. I think
my theory is correct. I think like, cause he's already steaming ahead.
And I think another thing is happening too, which is that he's not reading out anything that people write in their final Jeopardy response that is not the response to the to the clue. Yeah. Because that's tournament shit, baby. You guys don't get to do this in regular gameplay. You don't get to play around. You don't get to say bring it. You don't get to write down extra stuff in Final Jeopardy. That's not, I think they're trying to discourage it at this point. I really wonder what's going on backstage and like what they're telling them.
That was a big Alex thing, was he never read extraneous Final Jeopardy stuff. If you made it your answer, he would. Like, obviously, the famous moment from Dhruv Gore, where he wrote down, "What is We Love You, Alex?"
Yeah.
Like, if you just abandoned answering and you wrote down, like, a joke answer or a shout-out, he would read that. But if you wrote down the correct answer and then a shout-out, Alex never read it, ever.
Yeah.
So I feel like that's they're cracking down on that again, I think.
Honestly, it would have been pretty funny if he hadn't read Dhruv Gore's We Love You, Alex.
Like, what is,
just came up on screen, he's like, what is, he didn't write it down. He didn't write it down anything useful.
He obviously didn't come up with the right answer. So too bad. Thanks, Dhruv, for coming out. They just immediately like close the blue window. Thumbs up. Like, I don't know. Words.
All right. Well, that's our game recap for the week. Let's move on to anecdote of the week. Okay, John, what was your favorite anecdote this week?
This was we're going right back to Friday from Molly, and this was a real look. You know, when people say online dudes rock, it's usually in reference to, like, you know, I drank a beer through my ear, or like I don't know. It's all usually like drinking or like being cool or whatever. And this was a real, I just loved this story because it was a real dudes rock moment, but for a nerd, which I felt like nerds don't always get their dudes rock moment, but this was a real dudes rock moment for Molly's dad. So Dan, go ahead.
Molly Fitzpatrick is a writer from Queens. And Molly, I understand that even though you're here on the Alex Trebek stage, you may not be the biggest Jeopardy fan in your own family.
That's true. When I was born, Jeopardy was playing in the delivery room. And my father, who loves trivia and is a little bit of a sore winner, was playing with the doctor, doing very well, but cultivating an atmosphere that my mother, who was in labor, was not thrilled about. I made it. And now the prophecy is fulfilled.
It's almost like a superhero origin story, you know, like through the crucible of that amazing Jeopardy game was produced a future contestant.
Or supervillain.
Oh, we don't know yet. We don't know. You're in the lead.
This is where I have to ask you, John, have you seen Madame Web?
No, I haven't. No, I haven't seen Madame Web. But is this how it started?
Well, it starts with like her mom giving birth in a cave, and her mom's like gonna die, but then the magic spiders bite her, and then the mom does die, but then the baby gets the spider powers.
Oh,
so it kind of reminds me of that a little bit.
So that was what was happening at Molly's birth, was that her dad was imbuing her with the knowledge of potent potables.
But yeah, I really felt for Molly's mom in this anecdote.
Well, I kind of felt for Molly too, because, I didn't feel for her, but it was funny that Ken sort of said, this is your superhero origin story. And Molly made the joke, or supervillain. And then the rest of the game, Ken just called her a supervillain. Did she want that? Did she want like every, he's like, and here's Molly's final Jeopardy response, our resident supervillain. You know, or I'm like, oh, maybe she didn't want to be called the villain the entire game.
I guess that's another lesson for like, if you go on Jeopardy, is like, don't give Ken permission to call you something.
Yeah,
because he'll do it.
Sexy and cool. But yeah, great. I mean, that is a really great Jeopardy anecdote. There are very few anecdotes about watching Jeopardy that are interesting. Most of them are just like, oh, my grandma was a big fan of Jeopardy and I watched Jeopardy and she would bake me cookies and I have fond memories. It's like, yeah, okay. But that's a very good Jeopardy anecdote.
Okay, I'm going to do something unconventional, which is I'm going to admit I don't remember what my anecdote of the week is about. I just had in my notes, this is incredible.
Oh, this is a really good one. This is a really good one.
So I'm excited to hear it again as if it's for the first time.
Because I can jog your memory with one word, I think.
Don't.
Okay.
This is Joshua from Monday.
Okay.
Joshua Beckett is an ethicist originally from Knoxville. I love this. Tell me about the fun routine you have with the neighbor's kids.
Well, I'm outside my front door, and I've told the next door neighbor's kids that they can come pick lemons at any time. But the catch is that I'll try to scare them. So they try to sneak up, get the lemons before I notice. And the other day, I found them. I snuck up and scared them. And the 9-year-old, he dropped all the lemons and said, "Mr. Joshua, you scared me half to death. How did you end up like this?" I wasn't prepared to answer.
I was going to ask, you're an ethicist. Is it okay ethically to scare the neighbor's kids while they take your lemons?
If it's mutually agreed upon beforehand.
Okay.
I got to get a deal like this going because we have a lemon tree and we're just giving them away.
Well, you got to start building your reputation as the town witch.
I'm trying so hard already.
You're like, I leave trails of candy into my gingerbread house all the time, and these kids won't take it. I will say one thing, great anecdote, and I think Josh's general demeanor very much helped, because this story could go in bad
this
ways.
Could go yeah a number
he just
of ways.
Has such a genial demeanor where you're like, I trust that this guy means well and he's good friends with the neighbor's kids and this is all above board, but in the wrong hands this anecdote could be like a cringy nightmare.
It also just feels like he's giving off the vibe like the parents have been looped in, you know.
Oh, 100%. 100%. Yeah. Really. But yeah, I mean, great anecdote. Loved it.
Really good. Why are you like this?
I'll say this, I've heard a few times before.
He had his fingers like tented, like when he was telling it. I liked that a lot. Let's move on to response of the week. John, what is your response and or responses of the week?
I do have an honorable mention this week. This is some really good stuff here. This was from Ken, actually. So this isn't really a response of the week, but look, we have, pardon me, praised Ken on this show. We think he's a great host. He so rarely ever screws up, but he screwed up and the panic in his voice is amazing. It was so great. Go ahead, Dan.
Places that are also first names for 400.
A bust of the brawl-loving Renaissance goldsmith Benvenuto Cellini graces the Ponte Vecchio in this city. Allison.
What is Venice?
That's the city.
Hodgepodge for 400.
No, sorry, that's not correct. Joshua. Oh.
What is Florence?
It is Florence, yes.
Hodgepodge for 400.
He was panicking.
Oh my God. What do you think happened? Because to me, I was like, oh, he's just so used to Allison being right.
I think he's so used to himself being right. I think that was the blow. I think that he saw the picture, saw the water in the background, was like, yep, that's Venice. And I know that statue and it's in Venice. That's my guess.
You think? Because it doesn't, to me, I was like, oh, that's Florence. Like you see, as soon as she said Venice, I was like, really? Because to me, it's just like, maybe it's just because of, and whatever. I keep walking shit back today. I'm walking a lot of stuff back. I'm like, do I want to say that?
Story, and then you're like, I don't want to talk about the time that I made out with a fellow debate champion underneath that statue.
I've been looking at a lot of pictures of Florence because a member of my family went there several years ago. Truly it. I was like, oh yeah, that's not Venice.
Fair. And I've never been to Italy, so I don't know, but that to me was my thought, was that Ken just got it in his mind that it was Venice. And then.
Yeah. But he goes over the answers. I really think it was about Allison. Anyway. Fair. What was your response of the week, though?
My response of the week, look, if you know anything about me, which I don't think I've actually talked about this on the show yet.
You've talked about this on the show.
Have I? I don't remember.
Oh, you've talked a little bit. Finish your sentence. I shouldn't cut you off.
Well,
I don't know
what
you were about to say.
Well, I don't know if I've talked about this aspect of my life before on the show.
You have talked about calling curling competitions.
Okay, great. Well, then, look, curling was an answer this week. Obviously, that's my fucking response of the week. Play again.
At the start of the sport for 600, please.
Discovered in a pond in Scotland, the oldest known stone for this sport is inscribed with the date 1511. Allison.
What is curling?
That's right.
Yes! Come on! Let's go!
So this was almost going to be my response of the week because it, to me, what I liked about it is it sounds as if she is so mad she knows this.
She is actually in the Discord, and I would like to know, she is now in the Jeopardy Discord by invitation of Marco. And I would like to know, like, if she was, like, how she knows it. Like, was she pissed? What was going on? You know?
Yeah. Does she hate curling and also hate you?
I'm going to talk about this a little more in a future episode, but I do have a podcast about curling coming out.
Yes.
And this is why this clue is even funnier to me. Here is a line from the script of that podcast. Are you ready for this?
Yes.
This sweet, very Canadian film from 1963 shows us one fundamental thing about curling. Very little has changed. Curling is actually considered to be one of the oldest team sports known to man. A stone was found in Scotland with the date 1511 inscribed on it.
Oh my God. To be in your house when this clue came up on screen, were you just so geeked?
I was geeked. I was geeked. I was fired up. I loved it. I love anytime Jeopardy has a curling clue. It's like probably once every 3 to 6 years. Let me look at the J archive. Actually, it's hard because there'll probably be some other. Okay. The last, 2023, June 14th, someone guessed curling instead of hockey. So that's kind of cool. This sport reunites a remote Nordic community in Frederick Backman's heartwarming bestseller, Bear Town. Someone guessed curling, which is wrong. The answer is hockey. It looks like they have curling appears as a correct answer about once every year.
Okay. And so this was year one, and you better just store that nut for the winter.
I will. It's not November, Emily, so I will not be storing my nut. Thank you very much. Emily, what was your response?
As previously referenced, my response of the week came after Allison had already found both Daily Doubles and for some reason jumped to the $2,000 clue in a category she felt bad about, and it paid off exactly as you thought it would.
I'm terrible at music. This band's an institution for 2000.
This One Step Beyond and Our House band, formed in 1976, is still touring with its original members. Allison?
What is Foghorn Leghorn?
No.
I love that she said she didn't know anything about music, but thought to guess because the start of the clues said, this, I say this, like Foghorn Leghorn would say. Didn't think about, I don't know the songs, I don't know anything about this band, was like, well, that must be the clue within a clue for $2,000. I'll ring in.
I didn't even get that. I was just like, oh, she's thinking of Foghat.
No, I think it was that. I think it was the this, I say this.
Okay.
Is what she was thinking, but.
Yeah. All right.
Which is why Ken like overly corrected her and was like, madness. I say madness. Cause yeah, that was really awesome. And then I talked last week about Allison's Twitter. She posted a picture. She went out and bought a Foghorn Leghorn shirt after that and posted a picture of herself wearing it on Twitter the day that game happened. So
tight.
Love That's it. Tight. Yeah, very yeah. tight. Well, Emily, it is now time for everyone's favorite segment. We know the Jeopardy fans are fuming. What are they fuming about this week?
All right. This week, we are straying from our familiar home of the U.S. Sun and hearing from, instead, TV Insider. And the headline is, Jeopardy fans slam odd Final Jeopardy clue. And this is the most like pushing your glasses up on your nose fucking article you've ever heard. Okay. In the category comic book characters. So this is about the Harley Quinn clue.
Yeah. Yeah.
It says, in the category comic book characters, the clue was featured in a 2020 film. She gets her name from a 16th century Italian stock character who often wore diamond pattern outfits. Both Sarek and Fitzpatrick correctly identified the subject as Harley Quinn, with the movie being Birds of Prey, while Nations incorrectly guessed it was Wonder Woman, which, to be fair, was also DC and featured in 2020's Wonder Woman 1984. Online, some fans took issue with the structure and contents of the clue. As one commenter on Reddit wrote, Harley Quinn first appeared in Batman the Animated Series in the 90s, so I think of her more as an animated character, though she has long since appeared in the comics as well, so that's entirely my fault. Also, I thought the reference to featured in a 2020 film was odd, since Margot Robbie has played the character in multiple movies, Suicide Squad in 2016, Birds of Prey 2020, and The Suicide Squad in 2021. I guess they chose to highlight Birds of Prey since she was the lead of that one more than featured, I would argue, but the movie didn't do particularly well. I love whenever there's like the fans are fuming, but the fan that they quoted say, that's entirely my fault.
Yeah, totally. That's my bad. I just didn't read the clue right.
Yeah.
The fans are pissed.
Another fan agreed with that criticism, writing, agreed that Harley Quinn is first and foremost an animated TV character, so it was a bit odd that the clue focused on her being in a movie and comic books. A reference to her being the title character of an animated streaming series would be a more helpful hint than featured in a 2020 film.
No, it wouldn't. No, it wouldn't. It honestly wouldn't. You think more people know Harley Quinn from Batman the Animated Series in the 90s than...
I think they're referring to... her being the title character of Harley Quinn, which is streaming on Max, and is actually a pretty big hit.
That makes more sense to me for sure than the movie. Yeah. I'll give you that. But saying the animated series thing is crazy.
I mean, this quote also is like misunderstanding the point of the clue, which is like to really help you. Obviously, there's ways it could be more helpful. It could also say it rhymes with Arlie in, you know, like that would also be more helpful. But that's not what we're doing here.
It was also a series of novels. Also, the actress who played her was Margot Robbie. Also, she was in the animated series. And also,
Yeah. Elsewhere in the thread, someone took issue with the generational aspects of the clue, writing, I wish the writers would not have Final Jeopardies tilted in favor of a specific generation, in this case, Zoomers.
That's not the question is just, what are those figures? That's how I got it right. The film meant nothing to me. Those figures are what Harlequin romance novels are named after, and Harley Quinn is named after that.
Yes. It's like an Italian figure that wears diamond patterned clothing. You don't even have to know.
No.
Yeah. And they went on to say, I doubt 5% of people over the age of 35 have ever heard of a comic book character from a 2020 film. Final Jeopardy should be general knowledge that is multi-generational, e.g. Shakespeare, U.S. geography, the Bible.
Okay, what? Those are the three multi-generational categories.
Yeah, Shakespeare, U.S. geography, the Bible. Also, okay. And then I do have just like a headline from the U.S. Sun, just because I thought it was funny. I'm not going to read the article. It's about Ken's flub where he ruled Allison correct for Venice and had to backtrack. The headline is Mama Mia. Jeopardy's Ken Jennings halts the show and yells, that's not correct, as Allison Betts wows fans with powerhouse third win. And it's like they couldn't come up with a pun, so they were like, it's Italy, we'll just say Mama Mia.
They're like, Venice. Okay, Venice, Venice, Venice. Dennis the Venice. His name's not Dennis, it's Ken. Kenneth the Venice. Do people get that?
Have we used Ken You Not this week? Oh, we already did twice. We can't do it again.
Kent Hardly Wait. Did we use that one? Did we? Because she didn't wait to figure out that answer was wrong.
Can I correct you? Is that anything.
That's good stuff.
Yeah. Anyway, that's what the fans are fuming about this week.
I love it. I love it. I love how mad the fans get.
They get so mad.
It's great. Multi-generational, like Shakespeare and the Bible. And U.S. geography.
I also like that they're like, U.S. geography. Don't try and ask me about a river in South America because I will not tell you about it.
Yeah, they don't have white people there. I am not interested.
They just got rivers that only Zoomers know about. And
You mean to tell me there's a river in China called the Yellow River? Does not check out to me. Doesn't check out. That's an English word. I don't understand that. Doesn't seem right. Not right to me.
It being an English word is probably what that person would like about it, though.
Yeah, true. That's the when the answer is the Yangtze is actually when they're pissed
they're
off,
like, no, right? No, I'm not doing one.
It's the Yellow. That's the only river in China, and we all know that. Yeah. You're right.
All right. John, let's do our Final Jeopardy deep dive.
Which Final Jeopardy clue would you like me to dig into, Emily?
All right. I like things that have, our general knowledge that have multi-generational appeal, i.e. from English-speaking countries. So will you tell me about Churchill and the word summit?
I do think that people over the age of 35 love Winston Churchill. I think
they fucking love Winston love Churchill.
The dude. They love that dude. They are like, that's my guy. that's my fucking homie, dude. So yes, the clue that was from Tuesday's game. A reminder of the clue. The category was words and their meanings. The clue was Churchill gave a word a new meaning when he called for a talk with Soviet Russia upon the highest level, a parley at this. As we know, that was a triple stumper. The correct answer was summit. So let's start kind of from the beginning and then we'll work our way back. So this quote actually comes from 1950. The Cold War tensions were beginning to ratchet up between the US and the USSR. And Churchill said, "It is not easy to see how things could be worsened by a parley at the summit." So he was likely referring to discussions at the highest level of politics and not actually meeting other government officials on a mountain. apparently, I mean, that sounds strange, but apparently this comes from his deep respect for Mount Everest as just like a stately mountain and something people try to climb. I guess he was like a huge Mount Everest guy. And he's like, that's got a summit. And that's what I'm doing.
Really, really lost respect for him. Just like anytime someone's like, oh, my favorite mountain, the biggest one.
Yeah, it's just, you know.
Like, are you a fucking child? I don't know why. I'm just like, no, you're not cool anymore.
Yeah, honestly, like, kind of my favorite, like, and this is sort of like a low-key place to visit, but like New York City, kind of like a not a lot of people go there, and it's kind of like a low-key cool spot.
When I was in third grade, we had to write our own what we thought we would be when we grew up and I was like, well, I want to be a writer, so I'm going to say that I win what's the best prize for being a journalist. And I like literally asked my dad, I was like, what's the best prize for being a journalist? And he was like, that's the Pulitzer. And I was like, and what's the best newspaper you can write for? And he was like, the New York Times. And I was like, okay, I'm gonna say that I'm gonna win a Pulitzer Prize for writing for the New York Times. And I was 8 years old. I feel like same vibe.
Same. Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. He used this terminology again in 1953, appealing for a will to peace at the summit of the nations. So now we're going to rewind back. He first began to be concerned with the USSR in 1946. So very shortly after the conclusion of World War II, America was obviously nervous about the USSR copying the atom bomb or the H-bomb, which was in development at that time as well, or there was talks of it being in development. That's when he first revealed the term Iron Curtain. He was giving a speech at Westminster College in Fulton, Missouri, where he was a guest of Harry Truman. And he was actually no longer prime minister at this time. He was very popular following World War II, but the Conservative Party was not. So he actually lost the election in 1945 to Clement Attlee. And so Churchill became the leader of the opposition. And so, yeah, when he came and he came to the U.S. at the behest of Truman, he said this to the American audience that Soviet politics are a problem. The Iron Curtain is a problem. And at the time, Americans didn't like it. They were still very sympathetic towards Stalin for his help in World War II against Hitler. But within 6 months of that happening, the sort of quote-unquote Cold War was getting underway. And there was obviously a lot of tension between the U.S. and the USSR, as well as the U.K. were involved there too, because of the USSR's expansionist policies. And so, yeah, they basically, his second theme, this is from, by the way, this research is coming from the International Churchill Society. This is a direct quote from there. Churchill's second theme, which he pursued during his time in opposition and indeed throughout his peacetime government from 1951 to 1955, was the attempt to deal with the Soviet Union constructively and improve relations with Stalin and his successors. So he takes over as PM again in 1951. Go ahead.
The International Churchill Society is actually like the only organization that fucks more than high school debaters.
They're getting so down. Yeah, the author of this article, Klaus Laris. Yeah, he's getting busy.
I wasn't going to bring specific people into it.
Well, I am. In view, though, of the nuclear threat and the Soviet Union's wartime sacrifices when fighting Hitler's Germany, a policy of careful engagement and cooperation needed to be paired with firmness. This could only be done from a position of strength. Eventually, in an election speech in Edinburgh in 1950, Churchill made it unambiguously clear what he had in mind. Controversially, he called for a parley at the summit of the leaders of the US, the USSR, and of course, Britain to continue and complete the Potsdam Conference. In this way, he hoped to end the Cold War and overcome the division of Europe into East and West. But there was obviously reluctance from the UK and the US to engage with Stalin on this manner. And from Stalin himself, but then Stalin dies in 1953. So there was some optimism. Eisenhower is now the president of the U.S. He doesn't believe the USSR is ready for this. And so Churchill says he's telling everybody. He's making up speeches. He's saying we got to talk to the Soviet Union. If we just talk to them, they'll be chill, dude. They're chilling. And he couldn't convince the U.S. or even his own cabinet that meeting with the USSR was a good idea. And so basically, Churchill just said, fuck it. And he sent a telegram to Moscow himself asking for a meeting with Soviet Foreign Minister Vyacheslav Molotov, but Molotov never responded. The U.S. and Churchill's cabinet were pissed off at this telegram, but the fact they never responded suggested that an all-Europe conference without the USA, that's what Russia wanted. They said, leave the U.S. out of this. We're happy to be a part of the European Union. We're not talking to the U.S. And Churchill realized it was never going to happen, and then he retired in 1955. So he tried to make it happen. It never happened, and then the Cold War persisted for the next 25 years. So who knows, Emily? Maybe if they had a parley at the summit, they would have made it happen.
Thank you for that, John.
You're very welcome. My pleasure. Anytime. Now, Emily, it is time for the final Jeopardy before we go.
Okay.
So this one, I'm going to be honest. You are not going to like this category, I don't think. But the category for your blind guess is senators.
Oh, okay.
I feel like I have to give you a hint.
Oh, really?
not like a hint, but this final Jeopardy asks for two answers.
Oh.
So I know you're supposed to be fully blind guessing, but I feel like it's only fair. It's asking for two answers.
Okay, I'm going to say Abraham Lincoln and Barack Obama.
Okay, well, here's the clue.
Okay.
This is from January 10th, 2018. The last names of these two current senators, one from Virginia and one from Massachusetts, are anagrams of each other.
What? Wait, when is this from?
2018. So they're both current senators in 2018. I'll give you one more hint.
Okay.
I would say, I know that senators seems a little opaque, but one of them, I would say, very famous senator.
It's probably Elizabeth Warren. And so it's Warren and Ranu. No, I don't know. Wait, I can do this.
Raw new.
And we're Arn new.
You're overthinking it. You're overthinking it. Think of like an, it's a common last name that uses the same letter.
Warner.
There you go. Yes. Okay. Elizabeth Warren and Mark Warner. No, it's Elizabeth. You got it right. So it's Elizabeth Warren and Mark Ranu.
Oh God. Okay. Wait. Do you want to do one?
Sure. Sure. Yeah. I don't. Okay. I know we're both doing them now, but yeah, let's both do them. Who cares?
I mean, what? People can turn this off if they want. Wait. Hang on. I have to find the link again. This is really good. This is
starts
really good broadcasting.
Ends okay. With an archive.
Okay, so the final Jeopardy category is art and activism. And
art and activism. Okay. I will blind guess Keith Haring.
Okay. The clue, though being added to much more slowly than 20 years ago, it's now 1.3 million square feet too big to display in one place. And it auto refreshed, and now I don't know the answer.
All right, we'll see you next week.
Okay, bye. I think it was a quilt.
This episode was produced by producer Dan, music by Nate Heller, art by Max Wittert. Special thank you to the J Archive and the Jeopardy fan, and to Klaus Laris and all the fine people at the International Churchill Society who are all having sex with each other, as is my understanding.